I'm Christopher Lydon. With Mahatma Gandhi's grandson and biographer, considering what the father of his country, assassinated 62 years ago, would make of the new India. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, from the Watson Institute at Brown University, which is just entering its Year of India, the India of Bangalore computer brains and Bollywood movies, of nuclear weapons and more than a billion people, the India of ancient ways of thinking and doing, and also a very distinctive modern dedication to social justice. Our guest, Rajmohan Gandhi, is a University of Illinois scholar as well as an Indian grandson. Professor Gandhi, it's a privilege to begin a series of conversations about India with you. You've embodied some of the family history in India's parliament, also on the Indian delegation to the United Nations Human Rights Commission. It's a joy to meet the author of Gandhi, The Man, His People, and the Empire. We get a picture in that book of you as a little boy of 2 years old, maybe, playing on the lap of the great man. I'd love to begin with you and your own memories of the man in that picture.
Okay, well, Gandhi had four sons, no daughters. He had 15 grandchildren. Mm-hmm. I was one of these 15. Of these, eight are living now. And this picture that you saw, which is in this book, is of me around two, taken in Delhi, the capital of India, with my grandfather. And, of course, such occasions where I was alone with my grandfather, especially as I grew a little older, were relatively few, because Gandhi, after all, was somebody who did not put family first. He wanted to make all of India one family, especially the poorest Indian, the most neglected Indian, to be part of the Indian family. And so people of his own blood, his flesh, his children and his grandchildren had relatively limited times with Gandhi.
What did you call him?
I called him Bapu or Bapuji, which is what my father called him, which is also really what everybody in India called him. So it wasn't a kind of very special relationship, at least as far as the way in which I addressed him. He was, as you can see in that picture, very affectionate. He was teasing.
Very relaxed, it seemed.
Oh, sure. Very. And he did give wholly of himself to his grandchildren when they were with him. You know, his way of greeting you, like other grandchildren of his, when we met him, we bowed before him to receive his blessing. And the blessing was given in the form of a big thump on the back. And although he was a thin man and an old man and a fasting man, that thump was a memorable one. So it was all our conversations with him were full of tease, full of fun, full of banter.
You were, what, 12, 13 when he was killed?
Correct.
What did an almost teenager absorb of those Gandhian fundamentals, including civil disobedience and nonviolent militancy, and also the more subtle things, the a less is more outlook, the idea of life as self-denial, restraint? What did you learn of that?
Well, on the last point of self-denial and restraint, as you can see, I have glasses. I started wearing glasses when I was quite young. And when I was 10 or 11, I was with him. And I'd purchased a new pair of, obtained a new pair of glasses. And I knew that he would want to test this, whether it was really necessary, whether it was, I was frugal enough, whether I was considering the poor people of India enough. But I was also hoping that because he was meeting so many people and he, and that he might not observe this new thing on my nose. But I was mistaken. He said, Mohan, which is how he called me, I see you have a new pair of glasses. So I thought I would hit back and fight back. I said, you know that my eyes are bad. I needed a new pair of glasses. You know that, don't you? And you also needed a new pair of frames, he asked. So this was his way of you know.
So interesting.
Yes. So he wanted, even in that conversation, to help me to see that it was my responsibility to think of the neediest people in India.
Hmm. Not to the point of blindness or being unable to read.
No, he certainly was perfectly happy for me to have a new pair of lenses, but whether I needed a new set of frames was a question I should ask myself. But that was, you know, one aspect. But to me, the strongest memory is when I was a little older than this. I was now 12, 12 and a half, and he was in his final phase. He was in New Delhi. And this was a time when India had become independent, India had been partitioned, and killings had taken place, both in India and in the new nation of Pakistan. And Hindus and Sikhs had left Pakistan to come to India. Muslims were being pushed out of India to go to Pakistan. And every day, Muslims who felt insecure in Delhi were seeing Gandhi. Hindus and Sikh refugees who had come from Pakistan were seeing him, and they were laying their unhappiness, their blame before him, their misery before him. And I would often be with him at this time, along with my siblings, sometimes with my parents. And especially at these multi-faith prayer meetings in the late afternoon of every single day. But these were multi-faith prayer meetings he held every day, open to the public. And this is when everybody could be near him, could meet him, even ask questions to him. And in these multi-faith prayer meetings, there were sometimes, or always, in fact, recitations also from the Quran, verses from the first chapter.
Yes.
So when these verses were recited, sometimes people in the audience would say, get up and say, we don't want to hear this. We don't want to hear the Quran. We ask you not to recite the Quran. So Gandhi would say to them, look, let's see what everybody else wants. So he would ask everybody else, and they would say, of course, we don't mind. We don't mind the Quran. So he would ask the objectors, protesters, well, these people don't mind, so you should withdraw your objection. And often they did withdraw. But sometimes they would say, we will not withdraw our objections. So Gandhi would then say, if we don't have the Quran, we also won't have the Hindu scripture. I will proceed straight to my remarks, my post-prayer remarks. And so I was often seated next to him, but to observe him handle, you might say, hostility, handle anger, how he did it in a reasonable way, and also, it seemed to me, in a friendly way. Even though these people were mad at him, he wasn't mad at them, nor was he afraid of them. So this is what I learned from this old man. To stick to your convictions, to be civil to your hostile opponents, but not to yield ground on something that was fundamental to you.
That's so powerful, all the more because it was that objection, that hostility, that drove the man who shot him.
Yes, to regard Muslim Indians also as his brothers. That was supposed to be his great crime. You regard the Muslims as your brothers. We will not tolerate it.
I think for most of us in America who've even seen the movie and whatnot and know some of Gandhi, all of those events of 1948 are mixed up. Partition, independence, and then assassination. In what sense, you know, did his work end in tragedy or in reversal or in a complete mess?
In a short-term sense, in an immediate-term sense, of course it was tragedy. Here's the father of the nation who's killed within some months of independence. The man who brought independence is killed. But on the other hand, as all scholars and historians have recorded, his assassination is what made Hindu extremism, Hindu militancy, discredited all across India. So for the following 40 years, Hindu extremism had no ground to stand on in India. So in a way, his death, as much as his life, worked to achieve his goals.
You know, I'd love you to sort of testify to the Gandhi legacy, which I think is immeasurably important in this world. Amitav Ghosh is my sort of teacher on this subject. But Gandhi's formulas, in some sense, or his personality, brought India out of the colonial period in a way that no other country was quite gifted. India, and England for that matter, did not go nuts in the process of ending hundreds of years of imperial domination. There was no Vietnam War. It didn't go nuts like Cambodia
or turn inward like
Burma. Sure. Yeah, or there was no cultural revolution and dictatorship as in China. And we're still, in some sense, trying to learn these lessons. Problems and attitudes that get worse in the war in Iraq even and must be undone again. This question of liberating enslaved people. This matter of freeing all people in the world to understand their independence, their sovereignty.
Yeah.
But imagine, you know, as I try to, imagine if Gandhi woke today, and first of all, he gets the news that both India and Pakistan are nuclear powers, and that there are chronic battles of Hindu and Muslim in India today, not to mention over Kashmir. Can we begin to imagine what he'd think, what he'd do, what he'd say?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think he would recognize, this is terrible, horrible, but wait a minute, India is still a democracy. Wonderful.
Yeah.
He will say, wait a minute, at least on paper, the Indian Constitution gives equal rights to everybody, Muslims, untouchables, Hindus, everybody. Thank God for that, because he had fought all his life for that. He would say, wait a minute, it's wonderful that although the Indian military is large, much larger than I would like, although there is the nuclear arsenal, which I did not want, which I was opposed to, but the Indian military stays in the barracks. It is the Indian people who rule. Mm. So there are some positive things, too, about today's India. And he would also recognize that many very poor people are less poor than they were 10, 20, 30 years ago. But he would, of course, be extremely unhappy about the India-Pakistan divide, about the nuclear competition, about the Hindu-Muslim tension within India, about the rights that the untouchables, so-called, do not yet obtain in practice, even though they have them on paper.
What would he say about women?
He would be equally unhappy about the continuing oppression of women in many parts of India. On the other hand, he would also welcome the fact that women are to the fore in so many areas, that in so many villages where there is self-government, women run the show in many villages of India. He would rejoice about that.
And that an Indian, Amartya Sen, has sort of given the world the whole notion that the root to everything that we want is education of women.
Well, and he would agree with that. He would agree absolutely with that. In fact, that is one of the remarkable things about India today. The Indian democracy is very muddled, very inefficient. But nonetheless, in so many parts of India, women untouchable leaders are running the show at the village level, at the state level. Hmm. And there are many complaints. It's very unsatisfactory in so many ways. But it is an amazing thing. But to return to the point you were earlier making about the essential difference between the freedom struggle that Gandhi led and much of India embraced and similar freedom struggles in some other parts of the world. Because it was a nonviolent struggle, because Gandhi realized that oppression that the British were displaying in India was something that Indians too were capable of towards fellow Indians. So the real thing to fight was the spirit of oppression.
Yes.
And we must fight the British, but we must not hate the British. This was a very tough demand he made. Fighting the enemy, loving the enemy, isn't that absurd? But Gandhi said, wait a minute, we must examine this absurd idea. Why? Because we Indians too are capable of this. And in fact, we're already practicing it. And again he said that what the caste Hindus do to the untouchables is worse than what we accuse the British of doing to us.
Mm.
So the problem is in all of us. British rule must end, and I will lead a fight against it. Absolutely. But I will lead it in such a way that when freedom does come to us, we don't oppress fellow Indians. Now, are Indians oppressing fellow Indians today? Yes. But would they have oppressed fellow Indians even more if India had followed the way of Algeria or of some other parts of the world where Englishmen were indiscriminately killed, where English women or European men, women and children were indiscriminately killed, and that was seen as the path of the freedom struggle? India would have been 100 little nations fighting inside each nation, fighting among themselves with fights over sect, over caste, over language. And because with all its faults, India is one today. India has its principles today. It is to a very large extent because of the way Gandhi fought and because of the way hundreds of thousands of ordinary Indians accepted what Gandhi was teaching.
Yes. Amitav Ghosh, the novelist, is so passionate on this subject that this was a peculiar gift and still a gift that we haven't absorbed and spread elsewhere, in Congo, for example, or in the Middle East, most obviously. Where would he begin teaching us, taking note of exactly what you've said, that India has been immeasurably blessed by its historic experience and that's still to be applied?
Fair enough.
Where do you begin?
Okay. If he was talking to the Middle East, or if he were talking to Pakistan and Afghanistan today,
yes,
he would begin by reminding them of his wonderful right-hand colleague, Abdul Ghaffar Khan, the Pashtun leader, the leader of nonviolence from the Pashtun country that straddles Pakistan and Afghanistan, was born in 1890, who lived till 1988. He was 98 when he died. An amazing fighter for nonviolence in the very Pashtun areas that the world talks about today. And he raised a nonviolent army of hundreds of thousands of Pashtuns. I've been to those areas, not very recently, but 7 years ago. And the people there still honor and venerate Abdul Ghaffar Khan. So Gandhi would say to the Pakistanis, to the Pashtuns, to the Afghans, have you forgotten this extraordinary man and what he taught to you? He was a devout Muslim. He wanted women's rights. He wanted Muslims to have the courage to have their own interpretation of scripture. He derived nonviolence from the Quran. And he, of course, fought harder than anybody else for independence for the Pashtuns. He was the toughest fighter against British rule. He was the toughest fighter against Pakistani dictatorships. You know that the British imprisoned Abdul Ghaffar Khan for 12 years. Mm. The Pakistanis, after independence, imprisoned him for 15 years. So Abdul Ghaffar Khan said, let me tell you why I believe in a nonviolent struggle. First of all, we Pashtuns have treated revenge as something that we must always practice. The revenge code is a great tribal code among the Pashtuns, as it is in so many parts of the world. And Ghaffar Khan said, if I tolerate violence against the British, I will be merely encouraging the badal, the revenge strand in Pashtun life. So that's one reason I'm against violence, because it'll reinforce the revenge strand in Pashtun history, and we'll kill ourselves. But secondly, if we adopt the violent method, the British reprisal is always 10 times stronger. So it is political folly.
Yes.
As well as something very serious for the future of the Pashtun people. So so the Palestinians should know that violence against the Israelis or against Jews doesn't produce what they are hoping for. And this is what the Pashtuns, the Afghans who are fighting the Americans also need to know. And of course, Gandhi would say, now look at this Ghaffar Khan and what he did for the women Pashtuns. And what the Taliban today are doing. So you can choose what you want for your future. So Gandhi would offer a most robust challenge, both to the Muslim world, if we can speak of this immensely heterogeneous world as one world. It is not. We all know that it is so different in so many. But nonetheless, much of the Muslim world has this antipathy towards the Western world. And the Western world has this immense suspicion. This notion that the world is bad, but these Muslims are specially bad. You know, this ridiculous notion of one flawed set of people, one flawed faith. So Gandhi would confront both sides in this divide.
What would he say to the Israelis on the Palestinian question? What would he say to the Americans in Afghanistan, in Iraq?
Well, he would say what he always said to the Western world during the independence movement, that the right of the Indians to independence, the right of Indians to have their own country, is equal to the right of anybody else to have their own country. So the Israeli occupation of Palestine is something that is not fair, something that is not right, something that is not just. He would say that.
He said it at the time. Even
he said it at the time, and he would say it again. He said it in the
30s, actually.
Yes, he said it 30s in the clearest possible language. And so he would repeat that. But he would equally say to the Palestinians, find the right way of fighting this, opposing this injustice, and not the wrong way.
What would he say in general to the American hegemony, the democracy planter, the overlord in the Middle East in general, do you suppose?
Well, you know, he would say to the Americans, sort of thing he said to the British, who asked you to be the guardians of the whole wide world? And why do you think that you know better than the local people what is best for them? Relax. Trust those people. Yes, they may make mistakes, but they are entitled to their freedom, to their independence. He would say that.
What would he say of the modern India that we read about all the time? We read about in Nandan Nilekani's book about a new India, Infosys India, outsourced India, a great land of technological invention and growing prosperity today. I wonder particularly what he would say about the persistently Gandhian Indian difference that remains even in that new zone of explosive capitalism.
He would point out, as he did point out while he was living, that if Indians were to become an imperialist nation or only interested in making more and more money, if money worship became the Indian goal, that India would really harm and damage the world in a big way. He said that again and again.
Meaning what?
Meaning that, say, if India was kind of an imperial power like Britain was, like other European powers were, and was occupying other countries or trying to develop other countries or run other countries, India would also exploit and take away people's wealth. And he would India would hurt needy people all over the world. And as he would say, while of course he would rejoice that poverty is less in many parts of India than it used to be, although he would point out to the hundreds of millions of people who still today are in tremendous need and poverty in different parts of India. So he would attack the smug self-satisfaction of many Indians today. He would object to the worship of money very strongly and the utter neglect of the people around you who are in great need. So this would be a tremendous fight that he would launch. Mind you, it is a fight that many Indians are waging today. Many Indians are not satisfied with what's happening in India today. So it isn't as if his message is forgotten. It's not the dominant message that you read in the headlines. It's not what many Indians proclaim through India Shining or whatever. He would also ask Indians to beware of the notion that they want to become top dog in the world. I think India's destiny, as far as I could see in Gandhi's conception, is to be a sister or a brother to humankind, not to be some kind of superior nation or race. We are 1 billion people, and certain things are going very well for India today. We are a young nation. Our median age is quite young. In China, too, is, of course, far better economically in some ways. But then China's median age is not as low as India is because of the one-child family, et cetera, et cetera. So India is going to be a very large element in tomorrow's world. Many Indian professionals are seen in wonderful positions in Europe, in America, all over the world, Australia, Canada, everywhere, Africa.
Yes.
So what is going to be the difference that Indians make to humankind, to
yes,
this
my
planet?
Question. Exactly. What is it?
Well, at the moment, I think it's very mixed signals we are getting. Will India really assist the world, or will India continue to push the world in this direction of hurting the environment, hurting the planet? So I think Gandhi would really want Indians to understand that they are to serve, to assist, to be sisters and brothers to humankind, and how best to do that.
I hear back from people who were at the TED India conference in Mysore that, in fact, some of these young industrialists do operate on a different notion of distributing profits and sharing benefits in the company and in the community.
I believe that is happening. I'm not sure that it's happening on an adequate scale by a long shot, but it is definitely happening. So the social conscience is something that is visible, even on the economic landscape of India. But it's not the only thing. Greed is very strong in India.
Martin Green's book on Tolstoy and Gandhi has a wonderful account of Gandhi's letter to an American student who had written asking for a little slice of Oriental wisdom. Gandhi wrote back, and I wonder if he would do the same to all those American students who flock to India today for so many different reasons. But he wrote this: "We are taught from childhood discipline and self-restraint. Though, therefore, in the East we ever fail to live up to it, we know that life is not for indulgence, but essentially for self-denial. Would that the students of America could imbibe that one lesson, that life is not for living, but it's for service," as he said elsewhere. Does that still apply?
Of course, it applies to India very much, and I think it applies to the world as a whole. I absolutely agree.
But is that sense of India's differentness still alive, would you say, among the young computer geniuses of Bangalore?
Among many of them, yes, but not among all of them, but among many of them. And there are, dotted all across India, are wonderful groups who are working for the tribals. We have the tribal population. 8% of India is tribal. The 16% untouchables, the 50% women, and of course, the great many who are poor. So, yes, there is a group of Indians in place after place who are committed to doing their work in the spirit that Gandhi advised.
Mm. On that whole matter of differentness, Gandhi said in a talk at Indore, this was 1918, he said, "India alone is the land of karma. The rest is the land of bhoga,"
yes,
enjoyment. "I feel that India's mission," he said, "is different from that of other countries. India is fitted for the religious supremacy of the world. India can conquer all by soul force."
Well, here we must, mind you, Gandhi also sometimes was capable of not using the best language. I think the supremacy of the world is not a notion that Gandhi believed in at all. But remember, Gandhi was trying to win all of India to nonviolence. Often he spoke about India's potential when he was speaking about the actual India, and sometimes he made that mistake.
Hmm.
But the actual India was not the self-denying, the selfless, the serving India. No. But that's what he wanted India to become. And he said to the Indian, that's what you can become. That is part of your story. That is part of your heritage. But that isn't always the reality.
He surely showed the world another way, and it made all the difference. I'm sure you've seen this wonderful YouTube moment at the start of the public school year in America this fall, and a little girl in the South asked President Obama whom he would love to meet with for dinner if he could choose anyone, living or dead. And Barack Obama answered, after considerable thinking about it, he said, "Gandhi." And then he went on to note, it might not be a very hearty meal. But imagine that conversation.
Yeah. Yes, I think it would be a very interesting conversation for a number of reasons. It was in South Africa that Gandhi really found himself and found his calling in life, found his vocation, found his mission in life. So his interaction with South Africa, with the nation of the Africans, and he had an interesting encounter with an African-American in South Africa, too, at that time. And, of course, we know about the amazing Gandhi-Martin Luther King Jr. connection.
Yes.
And whenever African-Americans called on Gandhi, as they did many times, he was always asking about the situation of the African-Americans. And the struggle against slavery had always impressed Gandhi, even as a young man. And I don't know whether you're aware, but in 1905, when Gandhi was 35, 36 years old, in his South African journal called Indian Opinion, Gandhi wrote about Abraham Lincoln as the greatest and the noblest man of the 19th century.
It's marvelous.
And he spoke of the struggle against slavery when nobody wanted to fight against slavery. Even the African Americans sometimes lacked the courage to fight against it. And still Lincoln did it. And so for Gandhi to know that Barack Obama is the president of the United States, the people of the United States have elected him, Gandhi would have been as interested in Barack Obama as Barack Obama is in Gandhi.
It's fantastic. I just reminded, I.F. Stone, a wonderful American journalist, said and this would have been in the 50s, but he said that African America needs a Gandhi and the United States needs a black leader. And here we are.
Isn't it amazing? It's absolutely amazing, yeah. And yet Obama has so many challenges. My goodness, he has tough, tough, tough challenges. So,
but I'm sure he would say, you know, if they were off in a corner of the restaurant, wherever, he would say, help me with Islam. Help me with Islam.
And Gandhi would say, you too have your links with Islam through your forebears. You have a tremendous chance to. And Gandhi would remind, he would tell Obama, of course, about Abdul Ghaffar Khan, his Pashtun friend. Mm. And he would say to Obama, there are today in the world, in the Islamic world, so many thousands of women and men who are fighting for the very things you are fighting for. They are the immediate victims of terrorism. Look at the number of Pakistanis and Afghans killed every single day by the extremists in their midst. You know, the Fort Hood has happened, and we are all very moved by all these poignant descriptions of every single life that perished there. But the Pakistanis, the Afghans who also perish, because of suicide bombing, because of extremist guns, because of being ambushed by extremists, they die unknown, unrecognized, unsung. But the suffering of these people, so many Muslims in the world live with, and they work against it. They want to end it. Often it's not easy for them. Often they are intimidated by the extremists. But also, and this is, I think, what Gandhi would say to Obama, you in the United States, for the last 40 or 50 years, have been involved in the Muslim world. Ask yourselves whether you really have been always fair and just to the Muslim world. And if you haven't been, acknowledge the places where you have not been. Because the anger in the Muslim world, although it is unwise, it is foolish, it is above all harmful to the Muslim world, does it have some basis in their experience with the Western world? So the United States, the European powers, must honestly examine what they have done or not done vis-a-vis so many Muslim nations they've had to deal with.
I can't imagine Gandhi wouldn't say to Obama in some fashion, you're a young, idealistic, global imagination, and you've fallen heir to the greatest military force that the world has ever known. Your military chief in Pakistan, Afghanistan, wants 40,000 more troops. Your ambassador says, won't work, dead end. How can I, Gandhi, help you, Obama, think through another way? Can you imagine that conversation?
Sure, I can imagine that. And I think Gandhi would also relate that to the situation inside the United States, where there is unemployment and there is suffering and there is sadness. So Gandhi would readily acknowledge that Obama's challenge is immense. And Gandhi would often also, he would be perfectly willing to say, I don't know what you should do. But he would also say that if you truly reflect and you think of the neediest people in the world and what would help them, then you will know what you should do. So Gandhi would not prescribe, you know, answers, remedies too readily.
Think of the neediest people in the world and then act. That's fascinating. Yeah. I think that insistence on social justice on the agenda may be the eternal contribution here of the Gandhian perspective. It is a terrific pleasure to meet you, Rajmohan Gandhi, and to have this conversation. Thank you for the book on Grandpa, which I enjoyed mightily. And thank you especially for this conversation.
Thank you, Christopher. Thanks very much.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, feedback at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.